favorite model of inflation, which fancy you can work out what it costs us to get the capital sky, then you can go and test it. It's sort of an unfortunate fact, though, that everybody has their own favorite model of inflation, pretty much, and to steal a line from one of my slides further in here, it's basically the idea that you came up with or the idea that your advisor came up with will be your own personal favorite model of inflation. And of course, because everyone has a different advisor, essentially everyone has a different idea as to what the most likely model of inflation might be. And so what I and my group of collaborators, in a sort of loosely organized sort of way, have been trying to do over the last couple of years, is to think about various ways of testing inflationary models as a group. And what we've realized is that simply looking at the spectrum of scalar perturbations that's generated by the average inflationary model is not going to be anywhere near constraining enough to tell us which model of all the models of inflation we have, which model of inflation, any model of inflation provided the perturbations we can, and so forth, we see when we look up in the sky. And so typically, then you force these very delicate extra predictions that inflation might make, any given model, most likely any of these quantities that I'm going to talk about that you might compute, they won't necessarily be zero, but they'll be small to the point where they're effectively unobservable, even in a kind of perfect copy pairing from a survey of the sky. On the other hand, if you were to see any one of these, then that would rule out a huge class of models, and so you hit the sort of optimist and pessimist thing. If you're an optimist, you say, well, I'm going to work on this because, well, as a theorist, I'm going to calculate this, because if this was to come, if this was to be actually seen in the sky, then I'd narrow down the possible range of inflationary models that I could have one tiny little slice of the parameter space. And if you're a pessimist, of course, you say, I'm never going to work on this because whatever it is that we see in the sky, it won't be this because this is such a tiny and obscure chance of this happening. And so what I'm trying to do is to hedge my bets. I'm trying to be optimistic in the sense that I want to be looking at things that would pick out very specific classes of inflationary models. But on the other hand, I'd be pessimistic in the sense that I don't look at more than one of them. I think it would be foolish to simply pick one of these possible scenarios and then put all your time to get them into that. And so partly because I've been looking at a range of different things. I've been doing it in collaboration with a big group of students who are here today, and also Eugene Lim, who was my postdoc for several years, who's just moved on to Columbia. Okay, so to sum up very quickly, what we know about inflation is that in the 1970s, people knew that the standard Hopper Bayesian model was highly fine-tuned, in the sense that if you set the initial conditions early on in the universe, you knew that the universe was full of either hot dust or hot gas or dust, would evolve away from this very special unstable solution that apparently we found ourselves even in the 1970s, you were within a factor of 10 or a factor of 100 of, which meant that you needed to be very, very tightly constrained because of the initial conditions of the early time. So what inflation did, from the kind of zero-order point of view in terms of Booth's paper, was that it took some essentially arbitrary initial conditions, and it would drive these initial conditions towards this apparently unstable solution. So it would take the kind of the standard Hopper Bayesian that was developed in terms of nuclear synthesis and so forth, and explaining the existence of the microwave background, and it kind of grafted a new set of roots onto this tree that would explain how it was that you could get a large class of initial conditions, all of which would get you close to this unstable fixed point that we knew we were close to. So if you just look at the sort of standard Big Bang, this is talking about the zeroth order cosmology, in other words, the simplest aspect of the cosmology that we could think about. And so it's telling us about that the universe is homogeneous, that it's isotropic, so in other words, that it's spatially smooth, and then it's flat. In other words, you're driven back to the k equals zero Friedman-Robertson-Walker universe. And so this is, I'm just pointing out too, that in this talk, I'm going to use a very generous definition of inflation. So basically, it includes any model where the horizon size is, co-moving horizon size is going down as a function of time. So I think in some sense, this could even stretch to ekphyrosis, although whether Justin would feel that way is entirely up to him. But I'm just saying I'm using inflation in as broad as possible sense. So the interesting thing is we know that when we look up into the sky, one of the few things that you can tell about the universe with the naked eye is that it's not, in fact, exactly smooth. And inflation, as it turns out, predicts this too, which is just as well for inflation, because if inflation predicted that the universe was completely smooth, we would know right away that it was wrong. And so what we do, as we know, we learn in graduate school,
But inflation naturally generates perturbations, and we know that for simple models of inflation, these perturbations can be calculated thanks to, you know, the details of this were worked out first in the early 1980s, and then it became sort of automated in the late 1980s. So that if you can specify an inflationary model in terms of its potential V of phi, you can just drop that into a formula and it will tell you what its density perturbation is. And so it turns out that these perturbations are described by a handful of parameters, and by a handful I mean in most cases just two. So in other words, you don't have a lot of free parameters to describe the primordial perturbation spectrum, which means that while you're going to constrain the model to some extent, this doesn't provide you with a huge amount of information about the inflationary model. But on the other hand, we know that because inflation has the perturbations move outside of the horizon after they're generated, we know that this necessarily leads to the prediction of acoustic peaks in the microwave background and a particular correlation between the temperature and E-mode anisotropies, both of which, of course, have been observed in beautiful detail. So this, the overall kind of picture of perturbations that you have in inflationary paradigm has to be counted now as a successful prediction of inflation. In other words, inflation's predicted not one, but two things. Firstly, it's predicted that the universe is flat, which is, in fact, what we've, what we seed it within a few percent. But also, it's predicted that the perturbations have these very special set of properties that you might not otherwise have expected if you wanted everything to happen inside of our past light cone. And you see these very special correlations both in the TE and also in the acoustic peaks, which is I think has to be counted as a huge win for the inflationary paradigm. So what it means is, in order to work out what the universe is like, we have to look at the lumps. In other words, every homogeneous and isotropic universe looks the same as each other. But on the other hand, it's the inhomogeneities that actually allow us to tell one inflationary model from another. And so whenever I explain this, I'm always reminded of the fifth line of Anna Karenina. It's a shame that Slava's not here, because it appealed to a Russian. And so he starts off by saying that happy families are all alike. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. And so then he goes on to tell the story of an unhappy family. And likewise, smooth universes are all alike, but every lumpy universe is lumpy in its own way. And so this fact of inhomogeneous universes that we're going to use to get leverage as to what's actually going on in the very early universe. The problem is that the primordial inhomogeneity in the universe is necessarily very small. We know when we look at the CMB that it's a parts in 10 to the 5. So we know that means that all inflationary models are going to that we're going to consider have to predict that the primordial density perturbations are on the order of parts in 10 to the 5. And so you know something from the fact that by measuring, the people who first measured the anisotropies in the microwave background got a Nobel Prize for it. So you know that this is a very, very difficult measurement. And so if you're not only going to say, if you say that all models have to be sort of, successful models of inflation have to live in this kind of very narrow region of parameter space, then telling one model from another requires us to measure this quantity that won you a Nobel Prize for work that was done in the early 90s. It requires you to measure this quantity to obviously very, very high accuracy, where you're not just looking at the overall paradigm, but you're actually trying to tell one model of inflation from another. And so this is necessarily going to be a very, very challenging experiment. And this is essentially why it is that the data can't, at least at the moment, unambiguously pick out an inflationary model for us to agree is the right one. So this is essentially what I just said. So the differences between inflationary models, given that we have to have a very small inhomogeneity to begin with, are necessarily small. On the other hand, if we look at all the inflationary models that we have, it's these differences that are going to be key to making a connection with particle physics. If I have some idea in particle physics, whether it's string theory or loop quantum gravity, or just some unified field theory, some idea, I'm going to look inside of that for some mechanism that will drive inflation. And so if I want to test one of those models against another, I'm going to need to be able to tell the difference between the perturbation spectrum that these two models predict. But I've just told you that this is the difference between two predictions, both of which require very, very sensitive measurements to see this thing in the first place. So clearly making an unambiguous distinction between the spectrum that's predicted by two different models is going to require a much more sensitive measurement. In some sense, in some very loose sense, you can think of the kind of homogeneous Friedman, Robertson, Walker as being the kind of zeroth order solution. The perturbations themselves are kind of first order, sort of first order respect to that. And now we're really talking about sort of second order differences between these different inflationary models. So the question we want to ask more is which model of inflation is right? And as I said, if you go to the archive, you can find dozens of models of inflation. And which one you like best, I think, in all honesty, it's really a matter of where you went to school and what particular prejudices you're bringing to the problem. There's no no one would say that there is a kind of, you know, an obvious contender for the, you know, for the standard model of inflation that everybody agrees about. You can certainly say that, everyone will say that there's an obvious model of inflation. It just happens that if you ask different cosmologists which that model is, they'll come up with different answers. So as I said, all of these models necessarily predict a flat, smooth universe, because if they don't, we know they're wrong already. So we have this zeroth order prediction. So we also know that the perturbations are a correction to this. We know that they're roughly scale invariant in the sense that they're, that the spectrum of the perturbations, when you look at them in Fourier space, has an amplitude that's roughly independent of their wavelength. And we know that they're Gaussian in the sense that if you look at the perturbations, either from place to place in the universe or in their Fourier transform, you see that they're apparently drawn from a Gaussian distribution. But even within these constraints, there are many, many viable inflationary models. Push my button again. And so we need to now look at sort of higher order effects in order to break this degeneracy. Because we're going to look for evidence. We're going to look for things that go beyond simply looking at a kind of nice smooth density perturbation spectrum as a way of telling the difference between different inflationary models. And so I'm going to now just run through a list of possible things that we could look for. The first thing is we're going to look at the same old scalar spectrum, but we're going to look at various features in the spectrum that may be non-standard. In other words, one of which would be a case where the spectral index was changing rapidly as a function of scale, a case that's commonly known as running. You can look for a kind of more extreme case where you have some isolated feature in the spectrum that is correlated with some little bump in the inflationary potential. As you go over a little bump, you get a big jump in the spectrum. You can look for tensor modes, which are modes that are, you know, correspond to a different piece of the gravitational perturbation. So we know that the scalars have to be there because these are the guys that saw structure formation. The tensors can be there, but they're not obliged to be there. And if we see them, obviously we detect them through the B mode in the CMB. You can look for non-Gaussianity or isocurvature modes. In other words, these are kind of departures not from that would not necessarily show up in the two-point function. You can have the same nice smooth perturbation spectrum, but you can look at the higher order moments or the changes that come from having, you know, more than one fluid and changing the equation of state as you move from place to place that then can evolve into a density perturbation as if those different fluids evolve in different ways. You can look from relics of reheating, which is to say relics that are left over from the transition between inflationary growth and regular growth at the end of inflation. And you can look possibly for initial conditions effects that come from inflationary models that have barely enough inflation, but not a whole lot of inflation. So you're still seeing, you haven't completely washed the initial conditions out of the universe, and so you're still seeing some evidence for some initial transient, particularly at the longest scales in the sky. And so these are generically what I'm calling fingerprints. In other words, these are the various things, and if we want to examine the kind of crime scene that is the universe and figure out which of the various suspects we have for the model of inflation was the one that actually, you know, perpetrated the initial conditions that we see, then these are the various things that we'd look for. And each of these tests are likely to come up blank in the sense that the, you know, most models of inflation don't predict any particular one of these things, but you would hope, if not guaranteed, that at least, you know, whatever the model of inflation is that actually drove the initial state of the universe, you would hope that it would potentially produce one of these things. And so that we know that we must have the density perturbations, but just to reiterate this again, there's no guarantee that any of these other guys will ever be observable, given the fact that we can only observe the universe to finite precision. So as you're all aware, presumably, we characterize the spectrum kind of naively in terms of this some amplitude, and then the spectral index, which for whatever reasons is historically written to be 1 for the scale-free case. And so n minus 1 is simply telling us how this this quantity changes with time. And we know this n is close to 1 to within about 5%. So we know that the scale dependence is typically very weak. So from the CMB alone, you can work out that probably the best measurement that you could imagine, and this is just coming from cosmic variance, not from thinking about foregrounds and so forth, is that you could measure this delta n to within about 2 parts in 1,000. In other words, we're looking now to compare this to the current best fit, it's 0.96 plus or minus 0.16. So if you kept the central value constant, you could imagine having a much smaller number, you know, order of magnitude more precision here on the right hand side.
Sorry, the delta n is just the uncertainty in the measurement. So this is just the measurement, this is just the confidence level in which you could measure, and it's just coming purely from cosmic variance.
Okay, I mean, how far away are our measurements from n equals 1 purely, and but there's some logarithmic running?
I'll get to that later on.
Okay, is that in your bag of theories?
That is indeed in my bag of theories. So if you were to compute this and you were to allow Monica's one of the things in your fit, then obviously your constraint here would go down. This is for the case where you've got a restricted set of variables, and so whenever you enlarge your set of variables, you introduce a degeneracies, and so you would expect that this quantity. So this standard here is in the sense model dependent in the sense that the more variables you put in, the precision which you can measure any given one of them goes down. So this is kind of the best case scenario. And this is simply coming from the fact that cosmic variance in the end limits your ability to measure this good micro crack. So this isn't running. Even with the best measurement of the CMV we could imagine, if we were to do this at another place in the sky, the CMV would look slightly different, and that difference alone is what's providing this quantity here. And so the problem is that typically when we calculate the spectrum that we expect to see for a given inflationary model, this you would think would let us discriminate between one inflationary model and another. This is a very precise measurement. So we have these two parameters, they depend on the potential. They can be characterized in terms of the SWOT role parameters, which are functions of the derivatives of the potential and the potential itself with appropriate factors of the Planck mass in order to make everything nice and and dimensionless. And then we know that these quantities, because the inflaton is moving, we know that these quantities have to be weakly scale dependent. In other words, unless you rig the potential very carefully, the value of its derivatives is going to change as you move from place to place. And so as the field slowly rolls in its potential, we know that these are going to change, but that change can be very, very small. And I've assumed when I'm saying this that we have, at least making this statement here, I've assumed that we have a nice regular single model that's based on a single scalar field with a minimal kinetic term.
Sure. You mentioned a bunch of slightly odd observables that you would say, okay, this requires me to go away from the generic class in inflationary model. But is there any observable that would make you think, okay, this cannot fit in any inflationary model? Does that go to the predictability of the
theory? I think if you wanted to look at that, I think you'd be thinking in terms of, say, a vector mode would be very hard to explain. The least force from inflation, overall rotation of the universe would be hard to explain. Some of these funky axis of evil things, if they stand up, might be hard to explain, although they could potentially be initial conditions transients. If you saw an axis of evil at L of 100, that would be something that's hard for inflation to explain. L of 2 or 3, you might be able to get away with. You want to look at very weird kinds of non-Gaussianities that I imagine would be hard for a reflection model to explain. Yeah. I mean, I think there's a class of things that would test the paradigm. But on the other hand, the fact that you see the strong evidence that we have super horizon, the perturbations existed while they're outside the horizon is strong evidence for the paradigm. And it counts for the huge observations.
A lack of acoustic peaks would have been.
So you can think of a bunch of counterfactuals, but a bunch of those 10 years ago, I could have understood
which are different. Yeah.
No, you can certainly think of things.
Once you say, I see something odd, and then I'll tune my inflationary models to fit it.
The problem is even if we can establish that inflation happened, even if inflation passes all of these kind of meta tests that we would be talking about, the problem is still, if you want to make contact with particle physics, the problem is which model of inflation actually happened. And we've got hundreds of models potentially, and so the problem is how do we discriminate between them? And even in advance of having said that inflation definitely happened, that's a worthwhile question for you. For the next 45 minutes or so, so we know the problem is that we know that given a particular inflationary model, we can't make unambiguous predictions on the basis of just if I write down the potential, I can't tell you exactly what we're going to see on the sky. And the reason for that is that we need to know how the universe behaves after inflation in order to make an unambiguous matching between the scale in the present universe and the scale that corresponded to matching a particular scale to the moment that scale left the horizon during inflation. And the reason that is because if we change the composition of the universe, then we change its equation of state, and we change the way that the horizon size grows or shrinks as a function of density. So there's a lot of things that make a difference here. Most recently, of course, we've had the onset of accelerated expansion, so if we ignore the cosmological constant, that would change this mapping slightly. We know that there was a matter radiation transition in the early universe, and we've now been able to pin down precisely where that happened. We know, for instance, that there's a period of coherent oscillations at the end of inflation where the universe can scale like that, in other words, like 10^2. If inflation ends, if this period is very short, then you move quickly to radiation domination, which then changes the relative expansion rate of the universe. And we can think of various exotica, like string networks, where if the universe is dominated by a string network, A is actually the growth rate is proportional to time. This connection model that Van Chung and his friends have been talking about, where you're dominated by the kinetic energy of a scalar field, and the universe, I think, expands, or the density shrinks at a rate that's proportional to the sixth power of the scalar factor. Or you can imagine something like thermal inflation, where you have a short extra burst of inflation that kicks in at some energy scale below the inflation scale, which people have advocated as a way of solving a microwave problem. So any of these things mess up our ability to make an unambiguous prediction for an inflationary model. And it turns out some nice work that Will Kenny and Tony Riotto did is you can, normally you see in books, you know, people will say that normally you have maybe 55 defaults of inflation, but even if you just restrict yourself to gut scale inflation, it's possible that these effects, you know, that sort of worst case scenario, could move you around by maybe plus or minus 10 defaults that appears from this fiducial value. And the problem is that will typically change your prediction for n minus 1 by maybe 20%. So the quantity that we were previously going to measure to within 0.0002, we'll measure it all right. But we've then got this huge this theoretical error in what that quantity should be. So that's going to mean that even once we've measured that quantity to this arbitrary precision, after we've spent billions of dollars applying more CMB missions, we're still not going to be able to simply dial up our list of inflationary models and tell us which one is the right one.
Because we've got this huge theoretical error that comes from this this matching condition between one set of, between a given inflationary model. And simply also, we need to make then a prediction for everything that happens between the end of inflation and the present day in order to remove this 20%. So if you have a if you have a full accounting of this, then this 20% goes away. If you don't know the answer to these questions, then you have to include this quantity in here.
In principle, it's never something you'd observe directly, but it's certainly something that you can fold into fits as a kind of the next year constraint. This is actually something that I'm going to talk about in a second.
It probably much better than 20% if you just take a small n.
But then you would have some prior as to what n, or as to how n changed with scale. So if you have some particular inflationary model, you could say, okay, if I want to measure this value of n at the scale, then I must have this number of e-foldings, and then that would let you constrain some sort of integral function of these quantities here. But in principle, if you're letting one inflationary model compete against another, then it's going to be much harder to do this in a self-consistent way. Unless the same theory that predicts the model also makes a kind of complete prediction for what the thermal history of the universe is between the end of inflation and the present day. So in principle, yes, but I think that would be if you were looking at it deliberately in a very small subclass of the total inflationary parameters space, then you could try and constrain something to do with this stuff. So the question is, what can we do? And so one thing that I've been looking at in collaboration initially with Harani Pierce, but also more recently with my student Peter Anson, is we're saying we can make sure that when we do fit to the parameter space, at least if we're going to assume a single slowly rolling field, then we kind of get the best value for money from the cosmological data. In other words, we put in all of the possible correlations between the slow roll variables we get from looking at the phenomenology of slow roll inflation. And so that is one thing. And the other thing we can do is we can think hard about the second order signals that would be invisible to most models. Might be visible for some of them, so that a positive signal would provide strong constraints. And so what I'm going to do is I'm now going to walk through the various things that some of the things that I've been thinking about. This is intended not as a kind of an exhaustive list, but purely as a sample of the kind of interesting things that you might see in some models. And in particular, if you're looking at building an inflationary model, then each of them you should tick off to see that none of each of these things is possibly going on in your model, because if it does, then you've essentially found a way to test and to falsify your specific model. So if we think about the slow roll hierarchy, now I'm going live on equations here because I know that we'll be able to talk about this on Monday, that had all of these equations laid out and all of their glory. But we can write down the slow roll parameter. So this parameter here essentially goes as the first derivative of the potential, this is the second derivative of the potential, this is the third, this is the fourth, and so forth. And in Hamilton-Jacobi parlance, we can write out a kind of cleaner version of the inflationary equations of motion. And it turns out that these things aren't V of phi, that the potential is a function of phi, but they're really measuring H of phi. In other words, the scale, the Hubble factor, but characterized in terms of the slowly rolling, slowly changing value of the inflation you can find. Push the button. And so it turns out that because these things are related to just higher derivatives of the same function, it turns out we can write down a hierarchy of differential equations that yields the behavior of each of these properties as a function of the number of e-folds in, which is you came fairly quickly from the equation of motion to the field of phi. And so that's kind of interesting, but the key thing is that these parameters yield the power spectrum. In other words, if I have an inflation model, it's these quantities here, at least as long as I'm obeying slow roll, that tell me what the power spectrum looks like. So these are actually directly related to the observables for any particular inflationary model. And they don't just tell us the power spectrum in terms of measuring spectral index n, but they also tell us its scale dependence. In other words, they also tell us how that quantity would be expected to change as a function of scale. And so we can take these parameters here, which are ultimately related to something that may live in gut scale or even string scale physics, and we can actually fit to these parameters with cosmological data. In other words, we can just put these directly inside of our parameter set and constrain these numbers using same parameter fitting process we'd normally use in terms of working out what the kind of best fit cosmology is. And so I'll just quickly write down the flow equation. These have a beautiful property that you can see that each of these quantities here as it changes as the unit, so n is just the log of the expansion rate of the unit, it's just the number of people. You can see that each of these quantities is kind of sourced by the next lower, the next higher order quantities as we move on downwards. So this L plus 1 here is going to be the next one up. So if you say that this L plus 1 case and all of the higher order terms are zero at some point, then that guarantees that they stay zero for the rest of the evolution of the universe. In other words, you've found a way to write down a kind of 3-parameter potential or a 2-parameter potential or a 4-parameter potential, depending on where you choose to make this truncation. And this is simply guaranteed for you by the shape of the, by the just the dynamics of inflation. And so once
These are parameters that describe the time evolution of the equation of state. Mm-hmm. As the equation of state.
Exactly. And so the key thing is you could imagine having some very special moment in the universe where most of these parameters were, some set of these parameters were zero, but as you evolve away from that special scale, then obviously some of the other ones will get turned on. But this is a way of trying to, so while these were the set of parameters that you keep will change as a function of time, the number of non-zero parameters that you have is on the other hand fixed with time, and so that allows you to kind of self-consistently truncate the equation, the inflationary equations of motion. So what we're doing when we do this is a standard model where you fit the data. If you go to a model data paper on cosmology, typically you'll take some data, you take some priors and some choice of parameters. And then you do Monte Carlo Markov chain fits to get back to the value of these quantities. And so typically this would be the amplitude of the tensor and scalar spectrum, whether or not it's running, plus the lifetime parameters such as the baryon fraction of the universe, the matter fraction of the universe, whether or not the universe has any appreciable scalar curvature. And then if you want to work your way back to the inflationary model that produced that, you have to sort of do this in two steps. Firstly, you take these parameters and you do the inverse problem to map them into these quantities here. And then you see if that would actually pick out a particular inflationary model. And so what we're doing in a sense is kind of cutting out the middleman. And if I'm never actually using the scale of the spectral index or any of these quantities to use to parameterize the spectrum, we're simply moving directly back to these quantities here that describe the inflation period itself. And so I've discussed this, actually I've given a talk on this here before, so I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about it. But what I'm going to focus on is what this approach tells us about the possible running in the spectrum, which I think will answer the question that Lee was raising. So one of the weird things, one of the really frustrating things about the WMAP dataset is that both the WMAP 1 and WMAP 2 datasets have seen some tentative evidence for the fact that the spectral index changes as a function of scale. And it's one of these things that theorists love because, it's like a 2-sigma result maybe, so we can all, it's kind of an employment program for theorists. Because we can spend a couple of years inventing models that have these properties, working out what the consequences of seeing this might be, and then of course a couple of years from now, WMAP is going to come up, someone's going to come up with some better data and it's going to tell us whether or not this is actually the case. So if this is true, then the scalar spectral index would be a function of k. And this is definitely non-minimal in the sense that if you look at the overall class of inflationary models, very, very few of them can predict anything like the amount of running that corresponds to the centroid in the WMAP dataset. And so if you already have epsilon and eta, you can show that the running is necessarily small. It's proportional to epsilon squared and epsilon eta. And these quantities are in turn constrained by the value of the spectral index that we've measured, because these quantities have to be close to 1. Because the spectral index has to be close to 1, so these quantities have to be close to 0. So if you want to have a potential running that's anything like the central governing map centroid, you have to have the next order parameter, the 6i parameter, which goes like essentially the third derivative of the potential. But now when you do that, it turns out there's a very significant tension between getting a running this big and getting inflation to last anywhere near long enough to produce anything like the amount of inflation you actually need to see. And so what happens is because of this flow hierarchy, this xi parameter actually sources the growth. Oh, hang on. Go back. This xi parameter actually sources actually forces eta to grow rapidly as a function of scale, and eta forces epsilon to grow rapidly function as a of scale. And when epsilon gets to 1, inflation by definition has come to an end. And so you don't need to actually run chains to see this. You can simply just sort of draw cuts in the parameter space. And so at the end, that some fiducial scale is between 0.9 and 1.1, which is not an unreasonable bound, then you're left with this region of the parameter space in terms of epsilon and eta. If we insist that the tensor to scalar
ratio is less than 1, which is again a fairly generous interpretation of the current data, we rule out this chunk of the space of the parameter space here. And then we say, well, okay, at the very least, we want the running to be less than 0, which in other words is going to drive this alpha parameter here measures the running. That's going to mean that the scalar spectral index is becoming redder as a function of scale as we move to shorter scales. And this rules out this wedge here. And so you're left with this wedge of parameter space. And then we can say, well, if we look at different values of the xi parameter, what is this going to do to this? Now, what region are we going to be allowed to have? And so it turns out that if we have xi exactly equal to 0, we can plot them. We can plot lines of equal numbers of e-folds as we move across this parameter space. And you can see that if you're living on this line here, you'll have 15 e-folds, which is nowhere near enough to drive a successful model of inflation. This line here, on the other hand, you have 30 e-folds. So you can exclude this region, as someone was suggesting, just on the basis of the fact that, at least for this three-parameter model, you don't have enough inflation in this model, whatever else is going on. On the other hand, this region here is allowed because it gives you enough e-folds. But on the other hand, this region you'll exclude if you want to have a negative running.
Against the theme of the rest of the talk, are you saying that if this indication in the data turns out to be right, so that future observations confirm it, that there is running at the level that is suggested, that the standard slow roll inflation is the trouble?
I'll get to that in a second about how you catch it up. But what I'm saying is that this is that the running is an example of something that you don't expect
to see in an inflationary model. If you don't see it, you won't be surprised. If you do see it, then you've killed off sort of 99% of the models that you might have thought that you had. So let me move on.
How dependent are those limits on the number of parameters and the number of flow parameters?
That's what I'm going to get at. So as we crank up the amount of running, so this is still a small amount of running
compared to the WMM centroid. You can see that almost all of the space that we originally had, these parameters of equal numbers of e-folds, these lines have moved up. And so this is still well short of the WMAP value. And even before we get to the WMAP value, you see we can't possibly have something as large as, and this is still short of the central value from WMAP. And we've ruled out all the possible models that would produce even 30 e-folds of inflation. And remember, we want about 55. So it's clear that if you just have this three-parameter model and you have this big value of the running, that you can't self-consistently construct a model of slow roll inflation. And this is the worst case scenario. This is now actually getting close to the central value, and you see we basically don't get any inflation at all for the region of parameter space we're allowed to have. So what we've learned from this is that in the absence of higher order slow roll terms, which is Will's point, if we add extra terms to this hierarchy, this statement becomes much weaker, that the number of e-folds that we're allowed to have in is strongly correlated with the value of the running that we've measured. And a large negative running requires, in this three-parameter case, that the total number of e-folds is less than 30. And that tells us that the only way we can get that to happen is to have the inflation happening below the TEV scale, which is unpopular for a whole variety of reasons. And you might even be at risk of getting down to the MEV scale, which means that you wouldn't be able to do nuclear synthesis. So in other words, the ways that you would patch this up, if you wanted to say that the slow roll model you wanted to survive, is you need to have a four-parameter potential. In other words, you need to add another parameter that made sure that the running that we've measured was in fact a transient running rather than one that applied over the entire range of inflation. And this essentially rules out all simple models of inflation. You can certainly cook one up, but everything that you would think of if you were just after sort of a simple model of inflation isn't going to have four non-trivial parameters in its potential. And so we ran Markov chains. I'm going to skip past this. I think the results are in papers. The one other thing we did is we actually ran chains with the first three parameters in the chains, and then we computed the likelihood contours for the values of n that you would predict, the total number of defaults that you would predict from the data. And so this case here, we haven't put a constraint on n. We haven't said that we just let it be a free parameter. And we see that we actually center around 10 defaults here, which is obviously there's an inconsistency here. The model that we've chosen for our parameters can't possibly be giving us a good description of the inflationary model because it's... No, this is with the free value of its side. We're not fixing the...
No, this is just done with chains. So the chains find themselves to this value of its side. On the other hand, if we put on a constraint, we want at least 30 folds of inflation, we get this longer tail here. But you can see that
obviously we've basically taken this likelihood surface and we've cut it off at this point here, and so we're just looking at the tail of this likelihood surface with this constraint that we want at least 30 e-folds of inflation. So I'm not certainly claiming to have disproved inflation. I'm sorry, this is one more plot. This is again looking at the regions in epsilon and eta, and in terms of R and the scalar spectral index, and in terms of this running quantity and the scalar spectral index. And the red plots here correspond to plots that were done with a constraint that n was greater than 30, which you see puts this very tight bite on the parameter space here. Whereas the blue plots were done in an unconstrained way, and this is for the new WMAP dataset plus the Sloan Digital Sky Survey data. And what I've plotted on top of that is trajectories for different inflationary models. And so in this case, this is lambda phi fourth, which was known from the WMAP 3 paper onwards, is ruled out by this new data. And you can see that even with 60 e-folds of inflation, you're outside of the allowed region of parameter space, whereas m squared phi squared starts off inside of the allowed region at n equals 60. But if once you got down to the point where n was equal to 50, you can see that, sorry, n equals 40, you can see that you can't, if you tried to push the number of the e-folds that low for this case, you can see that m squared phi squared with a very low value of n is starting to be in conflict with the data for this case. That was the data released from them before the Luminous Red Galaxy data set. But we reran the chains, but it didn't seem to change things in a really substantial way. Not Lyman. Well, it turns out that the Lyman alpha, the publicly available likelihoods for Lyman alpha, are characterized in terms of the scalar spectral index. And we didn't want to have to go through and do that again. We want to, if anyone is producing likelihoods from cosmological data sets, we want something that can take a general spectrum, not something that just takes a parameterized spectrum. I mean, in principle, we could have gone and done that, but we didn't want to do that because we figured it would be painful. And in the end, this isn't going to be especially, I mean, it's more of a proof of concept, so I don't want to dwell on a particular result. So the other thing we found happened is that the lake parameters typically moved around a bit when we imposed when we allow these quantities to run. So if you had strong constraints on these late parameters, which of course we do and we haven't necessarily folded in here, then that would again provide a tight bite on your cosmological parameter space. So there's ways out of here. You can add higher order terms to the potential. The other thing you could do is you could put a sharp feature into the potential, or you could have multiple fields. And in both of those cases, that would mean that simply your model wasn't well described by the slow roll expansion, which would mean that your kind of initial prior just had excluded the model that corresponds to reality just by fiat. And the third option, which I think is possibly the most likely, is, well, at least being a kind of pessimistic theorist, is that future data will show less evidence for running. In other words, as we get better data, the evidence for running will slowly go away. Because at the moment, it's certainly true that if this was to stand up, there'd be real tension between these two things. So just to briefly advertise some work that's going to be out relatively soon, this is with Peter. We're actually trying to identify different classes of slow roll models by looking at these equations. And then we're going to ask whether or not the likely experimental bounds that would be available in the future would actually tell us whether or not we're unambiguously living in one or other of these classes. So the other thing we can do is that we know that epsilon measures the tensor to scalar ratio, and we know that the amplitude of the tensors tells us the energy scale at which inflation happens. So there has to be some correlation between epsilon and n. If we have a value of n of 30, then we better have a very, very small value of epsilon. And we haven't yet fed that data into our chains, but this kind of self-consistency with a mild prior on the reheating physics, again, would allow us to put much tighter cuts in the parameter space than we've done so far. And the last thing we want to say is that there's two... I'll leave this. I can come back to this later. So the other fingerprints we could think about, just to sort of go through this kind of laundry list, is that the tensor perturbations I'm not going to address directly. We all know that inflation can potentially generate these. And they're a function of the energy scale at which inflation happens. In other words, if inflation happens at a low scale, the amplitude of the tensors is so tiny that you'll probably never see them. So the way people want to go after these is by measuring the B mode of the polarization in the CMB plus some for large values of the tensors, so you get some weak constraint from the temperature and isotropies as well. And the amplitude is typically characterized as being relative to the scalar modes. And so even the current upper bound is starting to be constraining in that we've ruled out lambda phi fourth inflation. And the next generation of CMB experiments are going to probe down to maybe R of 0.1. And this is not going to be a serious test of M squared phi squared inflation, which a lot of people would tell you is their kind of favorite model of inflation. But it may also be that the data never puts an upper bound. If R is less than this, it may be that the data will never actually see a value of R in the sky, simply because you'll have to worry about foregrounds and cosmic variance to the point where a smaller value of R than this would be invisible. And so the tensors are kind of weird in that all of these kind of secondary observables, they're the only ones that has a kind of fan club that would argue that it was likely to be detectable in a reasonable inflationary model. All of the others, I think everybody who calculates these quantities would agree that this was a kind of variant approach. But the interesting thing is inside of the string theory community, at least, you'll find a large body of opinion that says R should be on the order of 10 to the minus 12. And so there's real tension here between people who are constructing models who are sort of thinking purely about kind of standard field theory and maybe algebraic simplicity, between people who are trying to embed inflationary models inside of string theory, who tend to come up with these very small values of R. So if you were to actually measure a primordial tensor contribution to the spectrum, you would establish the energy scale at which inflation, if it happened, would have to occur at, and you'd basically rule out all of the models of string inflation with one or two exceptions, and one of which is inflation, in fact, which is a model that I've worked on, but with one or two exceptions that basically would find it impossible to produce a value of R that was larger than this quantity here. So there's real tension here between whether or not the tensors are actually something you would expect to see in a reasonable model of inflation. There are certainly people who would say that you would. And also, there's a large body of opinion that says that, you know, tensors are something that in reasonable models of particle physics would, in fact, be unobservable. And so it's not quite at the point where you could spin this as a test of string theory, but it's certainly true that it would put a lot of pressure on, you know, people who are trying to do cosmology and string theory would have to think a lot harder if we were to measure this quantity here, because you can see there's a kind of 9 order of magnitude gap between this sort of expectation and between this possible best effort value of R that we might be able to measure. The other thing that one can do is one can imagine having non-trivial spectra. This spectrum here was something that I calculated in 2000 with Jenny Adams and his graduate student. And this just comes from having a little step in the inflationary potential where the slow roll parameters get very, very large indeed. In other words, slow roll is violated. And people, for whatever reason, like these models because they can use them to explain away this glitch in the CMB dataset that occurs at about L of 30. And I'm personally, my personal feeling is that this is actually pretty far-fetched, but it's certainly true that you get a better fit to the data if you allow yourself to have one of these steps that occurs at just the right point in the primordial power spectrum. Well, you wouldn't
put them in the flow hierarchy because all of the higher order parameters in the flow hierarchy would become large at that point, but they'd become large in a very correlated way. So you'd have this whole lot of extra spurious string parameters where there's a model itself that you specify, you know, purely as in the potential has some 2 or 3 extra parameters.
What's the status of people who claim that with
the transplanting oscillations are a lot smaller, so they're not meaningfully constrained by any data that anyone's going to have anytime soon.
Because I kind of remember this paper that they actually tried to fit these glitches with.
That would be unwise. The glitches are too big.
You mentioned getting inflation from string theory. It's difficult, I gather, from the literature, it's difficult to get
inflation from string theory relation are quite perfectly known.
Yeah, that's true.
And so recent paper might take a lot of time.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that paper isn't an exhaustive survey, but it's, I mean, it certainly reinforces what I think a lot of people had already suspected, that when, if you find an inflation in string theory, it won't just sort of pop out at you as something you'll see as n squared by three potential. It will be something that's embedded in string theory in quite a complicated way. So it's not necessarily going to be something that just sort of pops out very naturally in theory. It's something that you can find out as kind of thing. Is there another question?
That's okay.
Okay. So, I mentioned that these models exist. The problem is you can't go and measure the unit as beta in order to figure out whether this step is real, because at this point you're not dominated not by experimental uncertainty, but you're dominated by cosmic variance. And so if this is just some fluke of the data, it's like in Delta poker hack. And so if you go and, you know, and when you play poker, of course, you're free to play the game again, in which case you can kind of reset all the probabilities and things start again. But if we remeasure the CFP, all we're doing is kind of taking another peek at the same set of cards. And so we're not actually going to learn anything new from measuring the CFP better. We have to find some different test of the primordial spectrum that is orthogonal to the measurements that have been done so far. One of those tests would be to actually look at the non-Gaussianity, which is still not at the two-point function, but at the three-point function for this data. And so you know that inflation produces Gaussian perturbations, and you can work out that in slow roll inflation, the departures from Gaussianity are on the order of the slow roll parameters, and maybe about 1/100, and some appropriate dimensionless quantity. And the problem with that is that we know that the best we can measure this parameter FNL, that is proportional to epsilon, we know that the cosmic variance limit alone says that we're never going to get below FNL as 1, in other words, two orders of magnitude larger than the predicted quantity from inflation. And so if you were to measure its primordial non-Gaussianity, this would actually rule out almost all models, you know, standard models of inflation again, because you'd have to do something to the inflation. It's not natural for inflation to produce a value, at least single field inflation, to produce a value of the non-Gaussianity that's this much larger than this quantity. And it's also true that just evolution effects alone also produce, even if you start with no non-Gaussianity at all, also produce a value of FNL that's on the order of 1. In other words, you've got two problems. Firstly, you'll never measure a value of FNL that's as small, and even if you did, it would be swamped by evolution effects that naturally generate non-Gaussianity from second-order effects of gravity.
But this can be taken into account.
What, the evolution effect?
Yes.
But you still can't get around the non-Gaussianity, around the cosmic variance limit.
Why are you mentioning the cosmic variance limit?
You can't, like a cosmic variance limit of CFB survey, not measure a value of FNL that's on the order of 0.01.
In principle, the higher constraints in non-Gaussianity become from a higher area, very high area.
Yeah.
So you are not actually dominated by cosmic variance, by other problems.
Well, the signal is getting small. I mean, the signal is getting weaker because it's so small.
So, I guess
what I'm saying is that there's a finite amount of information in the CMB.
Sure.
And because, as you said, it's a higher cutoff, so you're not being worried about cosmic variance, you're worried about foreground. So the point is even though you have this prediction for the non-Gaussianity, finding it in practice is something that's next to impossible.
Yeah.
So if you want a primordial non-Gaussianity, you have to go beyond simple slow roll inflation.
Yeah, so I'm confused about the last 2 points. If cosmic variance gives you a limit of order 1, then wouldn't the detection just be explainable away by cosmic variance?
No, because we're saying we measured a quantity of order. So this is just a limit. So if you measured this of order 10, now if you actually had a detection of this number that was, you know, say 10 or 20, then that would be larger. You know, you'd then be able to separate that from the cosmic variance. On the other hand, if this quantity really is 1, then you won't be able to meaningfully separate it.
But is it still consistent with data that it could be so large?
The current best values for this quantity are on the order of hundreds. So the doubling that constraint in this is on, I can't remember, it's like plus or minus 200, 240 or something else. It's centered around 0, but it's 2 orders of magnitude higher than this limit, and then there's another 2 orders of magnitude to get down to this prediction. So if you've got
Lyman's claim is that 12 years of WMAP data will get you down to FNL 20. So it's a long haul.
Yeah, I don't think anyone's holding me breath. So if you want to have non-Gaussianity, you have to get away from single field slow roll. You can do this in multiple fields, you can do this with a model with functional kinetic terms, like a PBI, or you can do it in a variety of string models. It turns out the one thing I want to draw attention to
is if you have a local violation of Soirol, you can also wind up with a very substantial non-Gaussianity, but now one that depends on scale, so you can't measure it with this FNL quantity, which is just a scalar that's been averaged over all scales. And this is something that I've been looking at with Zingang Chen and Eugene Lim, and we've actually calculated the non-Gaussianity for these stick models. And we can show that some analog of FNL, this is now looking at just equilateral triangles, and we're not looking at the more complicated set of triangles, we can push this parameter for this step potential. This is for the best fit set from the paper that actually fitted the step to the WMF data. We can see that the signal is actually amplified by about three orders of magnitude for what you get for just standard slow rock. And whether or not you actually see it on the sky is still an open question. We're working on that now because this is actually washed out when you project it onto the sky, or potentially there's cancellations because of this oscillatory signal. So we don't know whether it actually survives projection on the sky.
What is this scale?
These are just purely dimensions. This is just arbitrary units. So this is just centered around the step is, I think, centered at k equals 1. So this is
not an inference making process?
No. This is not an inference making process. The step happens at k equals 1, but then you can just move that around depending on where you want the step.
Yeah, but how wide is it?
It's about a factor of 10. So it'll be about a factor of 10 in L. So this would be a signal that would start at L equals 30 and maybe go up to L through 400. So you have to worry that this signal might be washed out, but on the other hand, the two-point signal that you've predicted, you have a form for that, and so this signal has to be correlated with the variant form of the two-point function. And so in principle, at least, you could create a matched filter and you could do a better job of pulling this particular signal out of the noise. Now, I'm not holding my breath for this to happen. All I'm saying is that this kind of raises the stakes for people who want to explain these glitches in the WMF data by using funky potentials, because suddenly we've come up with another quantity that may be potentially observable, that has a very funny form, because typically you'd expect this to be scaled, independent of scale, and it's a way of actually trying to put a tighter constraint on something that otherwise you'd only be able to beat your head against because you're limited by cosmic variance. The other thing we've looked at is inflationary models that have significant initial transients that come from their initial conditions. And again, these typically produce an amplification of this FNL parameter of about two orders of magnitude. The problem is that these affect the longest possible scales, which are most dominated by cosmic variance. So even though we can get this FNL parameter up to a order one for very, very long scales, we don't think we'd ever be able to observe it in practice because of cosmic variance. The last thing I want to talk about, and I'm just going to go through this very quickly, is you might look for kind of relics that are left over from the end of inflation. This is work that I've been doing with Tom Gibbler and with Eugene Lim. And in particular, we've been looking at the way that the universe reheats. And this can happen very slowly by a two-level coupling, in which case everything is very smooth and gentle and you won't see anything. Or it can happen very rapidly by a kind of resonance-like effect, where you're producing particles in a manner that's akin to a laser, by stimulated emission. Occupation numbers of particular momentum states going up exponentially. And so this tends to lead to bubble formation, it leads to turbulent motion, and this leads to large density fluctuations at very small co-moving scales that correspond to the size of the universe at the end of inflation. In other words, that can be anything from a few centimeters to maybe a few million kilometers in the present universe. So these aren't the sort of fluctuations that can see cosmological structure. They're only able to the only way that we see them, it turns out, as if they were to leave some gravitational waves behind, and then we could see the gravitational wave spectrum, which is allowed to propagate freely since the end of inflation. And so just to remind you of the different observables that we've been talking about, if you observe primordial perturbations, you know you're talking about some chunk of the potential that's well away from the minimum. If people had to detect primordial gravitational waves directly by a BPO, you're looking at considerably lower scales, considerably smaller physical scales, in other words, considerably different values of that of the inflationary, considerably different location in the power spectrum. And if we look at preheating, we're actually looking at physics that corresponds to the potential gap here, and it's coupling to other fields. So anything that we saw in this way would obviously correspond to a piece of the inflationary potential that hasn't been previously constrained by anything that people have talked about. So I'm not going to go through the maps of this because I'm running out of time. I'm going to say this is a picture of parametric resonance with beginners. This is taking something very heavy, you can tie a fridge magnet to it, and pull it at just the right frequency that this thing can move, and you can see this demonstration in science centers, and you can actually start this in a big block of concrete moving just by a series of very gentle types, and parametric resonance is essentially working in the same way, it's essentially a forced harmonic oscillator. So this is a simulation of what happens in the universe. This is the inflaton field oscillating about the bottom of its potential in some rescaled set of units. And what happens is it's coupled to some phi field. And if you look at the Fourier modes of this phi field, they obey a differential equation of the Macri form. And the modes that grow exponentially then force the density perturbations of this field becomes very inhomogeneous. And the spatial gradients of these fields then source the production of gravitational waves. And so this isn't gravitational waves that are produced as quantum fluctuations during inflation. Almost done. These are gravitational waves that are produced in the good old-fashioned kind of one-bit way. It's simply got a non-quadrupole nonlinear matter distribution, and it's changing as a function of time. And so each point in your space at the end of inflation becomes a little antenna that's that's generating gravitational radiation. And because gravitational waves don't interact with anything, the only thing that happens to them is they get diluted by the expansion of the universe. But they're certainly not, they can't decay, or they can't sort of be somehow eliminated from the universe after they've been created. So eventually, back reaction on the inflaton ends the resonance, so this process only lasts for a finite amount of time. And you can see that this is necessarily a fairly nonlinear process, and then we have to compute the gradients of the universe that we generated in this way, so it's a tough numerical problem, but it's one we think is likely solved. And I would add that it's also a problem that a group that primarily at CETA has been working on, and where we can compare our two sets of calculations, the two very different algorithms appear to pretty much overlap with each other, which is obviously very gratifying to us. But the interesting thing about this is that you wind up with a fairly sharp peak in terms of the spectrum of gravitational waves, and that peak is actually the scale of that peak in the present universe. You can argue, I'm not going to go through the math here because it's just flashing the 5-minute warning. But you can show that this is correlated with the value of the energy scale at the end of inflation. And so an inflationary model that's happening at comparatively low scales produces this spectrum of gravitational waves at wavelengths that are comparatively redder wavelengths compared to what you'd get from a gut scale model. A gut scale model would produce its waves in the gigahertz range, which is a model that is obviously going to producing gravitational waves that are essentially impossible to detect using current technology. But it turns out that if you have inflation at about 10 to the 9 GeV, you're producing something that sits right on top of the LIGO band. You go down another couple of orders of magnitude, and you're producing something that would be visible to BVO. So the weird thing about this is that these gravitational waves actually become easier to see as you lower the inflation risk scale, whereas the gravitational waves that you're measuring with respect to R both becomes harder to see as you're changing the inflationary scale. So you're sort of boxing the model in two different ways. The height of the peak is model dependent, but on the other hand, if you don't change the peaking dynamics as a function of scale, the most gravitational waves you can typically produce at a phase transition amounts to turning about 10 to the minus 10 of the total energy density of the universe into gravitational radiation. And that is essentially a model independent quantity, so you have an upper bound. And it turns out that if you have very weak resonance or certain parameters, you can potentially be much lower than the upper bound. So that tells you what the maximum signal you can see is, and it also tells you it doesn't tell you that signal has to be there. It just tells you that signal might be there. And certainly, the models of inflation when you don't have resonance. So I just want to flash this plot here. These correspond to actual calculations. We sort of rigged up a model so that we could change the inflationary scale while leaving the structure of resonance unchanged. And you can see that all of these models here have this quantity is in some sense a measure of the energy density of inflation. And we've done that as a function of frequency. This is frequency in the present epoch down here. And you can see at 10 to the 9 GeV, we're looking at something that's in the kilohertz range. And model at 10 to the 15 GeV, we're up in the gigahertz range. And so this, it turns out now to compare that to what would actually be measured in the sky. This corresponds to M-squared phi-squared. This is lambda phi-4. So these models don't correspond to any kind of detector that people are currently working on with the necessary sensitivity. As we push down a lot, advanced LIGO sort of just has a little notch out of this band that it might be able to detect. But on the other hand, BVO, if you were unlucky and it didn't observe any gravitational waves because the inflationary scale was at the TV scale or something, so right down here, it turns out that BVO would essentially be able to observe the signal from a very broad chunk of the parameter space. In some sense, if inflation happens at low scales and if there was parametric resonance at the end of it, then this is something that would essentially provide a sort of consolation prize for BVO, etc. So I just want to say that this work on gravitational radiation is still a work in progress. It was originally started about 10 years ago by a paper by Philip Collins-Katchett, and is largely ignored, at least by the gravitational wave community. But just recently, we've sort of opened this question up again. And it opens a completely new window into inflationary physics. Again, it's something that you wouldn't expect to see in every inflationary model, or in gut scale inflation is probably in a place that would, from a practical point of view, would be very, very hard to observe. But it's certainly something that if you were to see it, you'd learn something very new, you'd get some very, very tight constraints on whatever the inflationary mechanism was.
I thought that conclusion was another extremistic.
Well, they didn't look at how this signal moved as a function of scale. And so they only looked at gut scale inflation. They saw a pretty big signal, but they saw a signal at a frequency where the detection of these things is particularly hard. The reason for this is that detecting a gravitational wave, the strain sensitivity you need goes as the third power of the frequency. So if I go from LIGO scales up to gigahertz scales, then I need a much, much more sensitive detector, but I need to be able to build it on a tabletop. And so from a technical point of view, that becomes very hard. But if you think about the inflationary scale as a free parameter, then it turns out that, if you're down sort of below 10 to the 9 GeV, then it turns out that this signal basically sits on top of BBO. And BBO has more than the amount of sensitivity that you need to see this. That's what I'm saying. I'm talking about it, and I'm saying that that's obviously not something that you'd suggest anyone went to do. On the other hand, if you have an inflationary model that's at very, very low scales, which is certainly feasible theoretically, then it turns out that this signal would actually correspond to gravitational wave detectors. They're not being built, but they're certainly on the drawing board in terms of advanced wave, in terms of BBO. So that would seem to be in the range of what is technically feasible. Obviously, if someone has a very good idea for gravitational wave detection at gigahertz scale, then I'd love to hear it, because that would correspond to gut scale inflation. But again, I'm not holding my breath there. So I think I'll just skip over this, and I've got my 0 minute sign, which is good. We haven't looked at the Kurbatov case directly, but anything where you have resonance at the end of inflation, but in principle at least, would be able to generate this. But then you need to actually go and look at the details of that and figure out whether the power that's produced actually saturates this 10 to the minus 10 bound, or whether it's substantially less. And there are models where you do have resonance, where you do generate gravitational waves, but their amplitude is well below that bound. And so just having resonance alone isn't a guarantee that the signal would be produced in a detectable way.
Yeah. But also in the general analysis, not only the gravitational waves, the whole thing that should be.
Oh, we haven't thought explicitly about Kurbatov models. I guess the non-Gaussianity of the isocurvature most would be the sort of thing that you'd go and look for. Again, Kurbatov models potentially lead to predictions that are different, or that are somehow categorically different from what you get from standard slow roll inflation. So that would be, again, an example of a kind of special class of models that had kind of fingerprints that were different from the general run of models. So, I certainly haven't gone through every possible fingerprint. I focused on the things that I've been thinking about. But I think in the case of Kurbatov, you want the non-Gaussianity, obviously, and you want the possibility of isocurvature as well, that we talked about before. So just to summarize, there may be more to inflation than the scalar spectrum, but we can't be sure. It's certainly possible that all of the kind of variant signals that I've thought about would be completely undetectable. Now, you could cook up an inflationary model where none of these things would be detectable in any meaningful way. There'd be no running, there'd be no tensors, there'd be no gravitational waves at the end of inflation, there'd be no non-Gaussianity, there'd be none of these things. All you'd have would be the scalar spectrum. So the inflationary paradigm is in good shape, I think, but there's little clue as to the details of the inflationary model. And that's because for inflation to work, all viable inflationary models have to be roughly similar, because they've all had to kind of concentrate themselves in this little region of parameter space. And so if we focus on rare fingerprints, we won't see them in most models, so this is a pessimistic thing, so you're wasting a lot of time calculating something. On the other hand, if you do see them, you get very, very strong constraints on the inflationary parameter space, and because there's a whole bunch of different possible sort of non-standard predictions that inflation might produce, you have to simply hope that if you really want to put a strong bite on the inflationary parameter space, if inflation did in fact provide the initial conditions we see in the universe, it's not too unreasonable to hope that at least one of these potential second-order fingerprints would in fact be visible at the start, and that would let us pick out that model in some detail. So I guess the message here is that if you're actually building an inflationary model, then you actually do want to think very carefully about its likely observational consequences rather than just calculate the aspect that can be done with it. Okay.
So one of the issues I always ask Lev that I will ask you is how essentially preheating is a phenomenology in terms of usually dealing with two fields, with a strength parameter, which is described as coupling. But one might expect, maybe even hope, that what happens in preheating is that you produce the standard model.
Occasionally,
yes. Well, what that means is that a lot of degrees of freedom should open up in a fairly rapid order, which effectively, I think, is analogous to increasing your G or something. Is that an equivalent parameterization?
I think what happens is you find that initially, at least, you have lots of fields. You know, this chi field is kind of stands in for the entire matter content of the universe.
No, but let me try and get to the question, the issue. So one might suppose that the really non-equilibrium preheating phase is really pretty short, and that would have an impact to decrease the gravity wave amounts, because once you get into a fairly uniform equilibrium situation, of course, you aren't producing any.
Well, I'm not sure whether that's true or not, because...
Well, we obviously don't know if it's true, it's just that...
No, I'm not even sure whether this is true, because if you have a very rapid production of the particle, if this production is very rapid, then it would depend... I think the answer to that question is model dependent. It would be possible to imagine cases where you're coupled to more than one field, and you were pumping many fields, but on the other hand, you still produced a lot of information ahead. In the end, it depends on how lumpy the universe is immediately after the...
No, but the lumpiness is created as a consequence of the nonlinear interaction. So therefore, you tune it up in terms of the number of degrees of freedom, then it always tries to go to equilibrate faster. That's just the nature.
And during what we see is that the gravitational waves are generated during the pumping phase. And if you have models where the pumping phase is relatively short, the amount of power you're producing per unit time goes up, but the integrated amount of power stays constant. And so we're looking at the total amount of power that's integrated during the preheating phase. And so there are some models that take a longer amount of time to preheat than others because the resonance is stronger or weaker. But both of those models are capable of saturating the limit. And so I'm saying that you can produce a lot of power in a very short amount of time, and then eventually, as you say, things will come to a halt because you're not pumping these loads anymore and they start to wash out. Or you can produce power more slowly over a longer period of time. And the thing you have to worry about then is you're going to lose power eventually because the universe is expanding and enriching away as the energy stuff is created. But it's not immediately clear to me that having more than one field is going to immediately mean that you reduce the amount of power that you generate.
Okay, it seems clear to me, but...
No, but we've got two fields, both of which have been pumped. Yeah, both of those fields are sourcing the gravity.
Yeah, we're sort of limited on time here, and we have to save this for the coffee break at this point and move on. Yeah, John.
You mentioned that with the running spectrum, that we can find ourselves doing four parameters of potential.
Yeah.
Potentially more parameters.
For forward, so... Yeah. Forward being up.
Well, right. There's the elephant story in his tail. So, the question is, at this point, can we falsify inflation? I mean, this is a negative question.
Well, I think Justin actually asked this question. So you won't necessarily falsify it by looking at just the form of the potential, because you can come up with what? A form of the power spectrum? Because I can come up with whatever kind of power spectrum I want. The way that I'm going to try and falsify it would be through like extreme non-Gaussianity, through correlations between some sort of anisotropic correlation between the CLs, but between the ALMs or something like that. I mean, if you're just looking at the scalar power spectrum itself, then it seems pretty clear that you can have essentially whatever you want. So you have to look at some prediction of inflation that goes beyond the scalar power spectrum. It's also true that some of the tests that we might have talked about 10 years ago, inflation has passed. You know, we've seen the acoustic peaks, whereas previously if you were to ask someone before inflation, would we expect to see acoustic peaks? They'd say no, because there's no reason why the phase of the inflation should be correlated. And it's a very, very unexpected result. Inflation has passed that with flying cars. Well, it seems we seem to have checked all the predictions that inflation has made, and then we have to check specific paradigms of inflation. But I think the paradigm of inflation is passed very non-trivial tests.
I think at this point, if it's okay, I would like to defer the other questions on this subject until we're all having coffee together and we can move on to Alex's talk. So, thanks, Richard.